Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy Horse Show weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every Friday. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days as a warm ear hug for you over the weekend. So, on this week's episode, Tony Blair's Spin Dude talks politics, deadly Irish people from the Paralympics, Wonder Kids helping other children with school stress, and a comedian on a climbing wall. So we begin the podcast with Alistair Campbell, who came on to chat about politics and getting children involved in that particular field. But we also talked about the British riots, Elon Musk as well, and I got him to open up a little bit on his old boss Tony Blair's catastrophic war when he joined the invasion of Iraq all those years ago. After that, we met two Irish Paralympians, Michael MacKillop and Peter Ryan. They are part of the punditry for the upcoming Paris Games, and they told us their stories, which are amazing, and reminded us that each of the 35 athletes going to the Games to represent Ireland in a fortnight's time each have unbelievable tales to tell. Straight after that, we reveal who are the flag bearers for the opening ceremony for Team Ireland, and one of them is a table tennis champion ranked top 10 in the world. It was good chatting to him. Stay with the podcast. You'll hear our two 16-year-old guests, Shreya Mishra and Keane Birmingham. They're involved in an event to help students with a big bold step from primary into secondary school and all the baggage and the stress that goes with that. But we also talked about what the general world is like for 16-year-olds in Ireland in 2024, especially when it comes to social media. And I think you're going to be quite surprised by their answers, to be fair. And finally, Dublin comedian Eric Lawler was in studio as our visiting critic. He went to review Awesome Walls, which is one of those places that are going gangbusters in the kind of booming trade of sober events in the country, where people, they basically go climbing for the whole evening and they hang out. And he nearly burst himself, but he loved every minute of it. That's everything in the podcast. Next Monday, I'll be back on the wireless, RT Radio 1, 9 a.m. till 10 every weekday. So let's start the weekend podcast. Alistair Campbell, he was once the dude behind Tony Blair, but as only perhaps a spin doctor could, he's been remade as a very influential political commentator, and he has that brilliant podcast, The Rest is Politics. And so now he's trying to get children thinking about politics in two new books. Good morning to you, Alistair.
Hi, dude. I like the word dude.
Do you? Yes, it suits you. I think it does suit you. You can use it at will. Come here. Your new books, Alistair Campbell Talks Politics, that's for secondary school kids, isn't it? And Why Politics Matters is for primary school age. That's why there are two of these. So, Alistair, children live in this kind of lovely place of innocence and maybe even lovely ignorance. Why on earth do we want to drag their sweet heads into the bitter, cynical world of politics?
Because it's when their heads are sweet and innocent and open that I think they're kind of most open to learning about things that matter. And I think there's a real problem of political education in the UK. I think you've got similar problems in Ireland, but not as bad. And I think what I've tried to do with both of the books essentially is not be party political. I'm not saying vote Labour. I'm not even saying Brexit is a total disaster, although I kind of hint at it. I'm basically saying everything that you care about, everything that your families care about, there is a political dimension to it. And it's important that good people understand politics so that good people will go into politics. And also explaining to kids that it can be good fun, that it's incredibly interesting, that it's something that matters. And I think that if you could just, I really feel that children need to learn about the very, very basics of how their political system works. And it's like, you know, we teach our kids that sport is good for them. I think we should teach our kids that critical thinking is good for them, that debating is good for them, that arguing and having opinions is good for them. So it's just a way of trying to say, before kids get cynical, before they're made cynical by the media, by their parents, by the society more generally, I go into loads of schools. I've never been into a school without coming out at the end of it feeling more hopeful. Because when you actually explain what politics is, I find kids get very, very engaged and very interested.
They don't realise they're already thinking about politics. They're just calling it something else.
Well, I'll give you an example. I went to the primary school that my kids went to, Gospel Oak Primary School in North London, and it's a very kind of mixed sort of school. You've got middle class families, you've got working class families, you've got big immigrant population there. And I went in to do a talk there the other day about the primary school book, and the head teacher had sent them some books in advance, and the head teacher had shared them out amongst the classes, and they'd had a session talking about it. One of the kids, he came in, and he was grilling me about defence spending. And he ended up saying, I don't think that the United Kingdom is ready for a war with Russia. And I said, wow. Why do you say that? And he said, and he was giving me statistics. Now, he'd gone away and looked it up. And, you know, and then other kids were sort of, they wanted to know things like, why does the king, because this was the time of the king's speech, why does the king make a speech about the government? Now, that's a great question.
It's a really good question.
If you went to ask a lot of adults, why is it the king who reads that speech? I'm not entirely sure they'd be able to tell you. Yeah. So explaining things like that, so that people understand the history, people understand how the constitution works. And then explaining to kids, the other thing that really, really excites kids is when you give them examples of people, individuals who have made a difference, and not always the famous ones, not always the Churchills and the Thatchers and the Blairs and what have you, but individuals who campaigned to change the law, individuals who've started a movement, and that movement has led to change. And kids get really excited about those sorts of stories.
Yeah, they love those stories. The book also touches on the influence of private education in British politics, because we know Eton has produced a couple of prime ministers. How do you think that goes down with children? Because obviously you're not discriminating on where you're hoping that this book ends up.
No, I'm not. But I do think that private education has had a massively deleterious effect on the development of the UK. Mm-hmm. Eton has produced three times more prime ministers than the Labour Party. Now, what I say to kids in state schools is, why do you think that is? Now, partly it's privilege. It's the fact that they've come from more privileged backgrounds. But it's also because those schools teach kids how to debate.
Yes.
They teach kids how to argue. So when somebody like David Cameron or Boris Johnson comes along, they don't have any problem with their own confidence. Now, you can see with somebody like Johnson, it's a disaster when it goes that way. But what I try and say to kids in state schools is, you have every right to be as heard as much as they do. But the one difference I notice, if I go to a school in a very affluent area, and then the next day go to a school in a very working class area, the one, you don't notice any lack of intelligence in the working class kids. What you normally will sense is a lack of confidence and a lack of belief about themselves. And it's trying to say to them, look at the John Majors of this world who have become prime minister from a background like yours. Mm-hmm. Look at Keir Starmer. You know, there's a guy who, I mean, you know, people used to laugh at him saying, my dad was a toolmaker, but his dad was a toolmaker. He came from a very working class background. He's now the prime minister. And I say to these kids, I says that, you know, my dream for these books is that on the day I die, hopefully a long while yet, but on the day that I die, whoever is prime minister of the day holds up a dog-eared copy of one of these two books and says, this is the book that started me thinking I could be prime minister. I'd love that to happen.
It mightn't be far away. I mean, our prime minister, our Taoiseach, is only 37 years of age. So, you know,
absolutely.
They're getting younger in places. The rest is politics, where you and the Tory Rory Stewart converse. And by the way, congratulations. Staggering worldwide success. I gather they're listening in America as well.
You.
I'd imagine a podcast audience also skews younger, so perhaps we don't give the younger people the kind of, you know, credit their attention span is a lot longer than we think, because podcast is very long form.
Well, when we did the Albert Hall, and ridiculously we sold it out faster than the Foo Fighters, apparently, and we're now about to do the O2 as well, but when we did some data analysis on the audience, over a third were under 30.
Really?
Now, and it's interesting talking to some of them afterwards. They don't read newspapers. They don't listen to the radio much. They don't watch TV news. They're very much living online, finding the things that speak to them. And I think one of the things that's wrong with our media is that we assume that people have got the attention span of a gnat.
Yeah.
And we also think that because our politics has become more insular, that they don't really care about the outside world. One of the things that our data and analysis of the audience shows is that one of the things that the Brits in particular love is the fact that we talk so much about abroad. So like this week, for example, we're talking about relations between China and Serbia. Rory Stewart's just been to Afghanistan. We're talking about, you know, next week we're both going to the Chicago, to the Democratic Party convention. Yeah. You know, they want us to talk. And America, obviously, everybody talks about America. Mm-hmm. But we talk about, you know, Bangladesh, about Venezuela, about El Salvador. And there's a sort of sense of our media has closed in on itself. Brexit, you know, again, a big factor involved in that. Mm-hmm. And yet the public are much more interested in the outside world than we give them credit for.
Yeah. And particularly the younger crowd, because I was chatting to two 16-year-olds here on the show the other day, and we had a discussion about social media and how they're kind of hooked on it and hooked on their phones. Afterwards, I was chatting to them, do they read books? They're 16 years of age. One of them is reading Bill Gates' memoir. The other one is reading a book on gangland crime. So there is,
yeah.
They have incredible
Absolutely.
Interest.
I'll tell you the other thing. You mentioned the social media. Another school I was in South London recently, and we ended up having a debate about whether children should be banned from accessing social media.
Yeah.
And at the start of the debate, everybody said no, obviously not. Okay. By the end, then one girl spoke up, and she said, "Look, I don't want to come off it because if I come off it, I feel I'm excluding myself from something that everything else is on.
Yeah.
But I don't think I should be on it." I said, "Why do you say that?" And she said, "Because every day I see things that I know I shouldn't be seeing, things which I know might have a bad effect on me that I don't understand." Now, she was the first. And then another one said the same thing, and then another one, and then another one. And by the end of it, we had a vote, and they voted. They said if they all did it, they would all come off social media.
Wow, yeah, they would have to do it together, that's the thing. Otherwise, yeah. You're the weird, you'll feel like the weird kid who's not on it.
What it's like at the moment, I mean, I'm having, like, every day at the moment, I'm having this sort of debate whirring around in my head about whether to come off Twitter, because, I mean, yeah. I think Elon Musk is an absolute disgrace, and I think Twitter has become horrible. But at the same time, I've got a million plus followers on there. You know, just before coming on the radio with you, I tweeted, you know, about to talk to RAT Radio 1,
Thank
and I know
that.
For a fact that some of my, you know, Irish followers will be, "Oh, I'll switch on."
Yeah.
And that's, so it's useful in lots of different ways, but it has become a cesspit. And so, but I think with that, I think, for example, maybe at the next European summit, if all the European leaders kind of said, "Listen, why don't we just all come off Twitter together? See what happens."
Yeah, it would be great. It would be a great experiment. And again, as I said, we have a young Taoiseach here who loves his social media. He could lead
he
the
does.
Charge on that. But not least because Ireland, of course, regulates the likes of Twitter from Dublin, because that's where the European headquarters are, and
Absolutely,
Meta,
yeah.
Facebook and so on. And we are hearing a mood change. And I was listening to your podcast yesterday when you're talking about social media and the effect it's had on division, disinformation, the erosion of democracy, as Rory's calling it. There is a mood change going on, isn't there? Particularly towards Elon Musk. Politicians are saying stronger things than they used to.
I think there's been a worry for a long time. I think the riots in the UK and Elon Musk's being pig ignorant sort of handling of it has exacerbated that. Then, I mean, I think Musk is one of these classic sort of, I call them sovereign individuals. They think they're above the law. They think they're above politics, they're above government. They're more important than presidents and prime ministers. And they're basically narcissists. He's a narcissist. But I think he's overreaching now. I mean, the interview he did with Trump, which we talked about on the podcast, I didn't watch, but Rory Stewart did, and it sounds like a complete embarrassment. And I think that what I was interested in when I was doing the research for yesterday's discussion, I quoted this piece from Leighton Andrews, a former Welsh minister, who was saying there's so much within the law already that actually Musk could be done for. And in my view, he should be done for it, because we cannot pretend, you know, I'm having a conversation with you now. You know, this whole thing about free speech, there are limits. I can't say, OK, listen, I'd like to take advantage by the fact that I'm live on the radio. There's a guy who lives down just near RTE headquarters who I don't like very much. I'd love it if a few people went around and just kicked his head in now.
Yeah.
Right. I can't say that. That's against the law. Right.
You would be in trouble, so, and we as the broadcaster would also be in trouble for carrying the message.
Exactly. Yeah. But you could get out of that trouble by saying, you know, we disassociate ourselves from that, or have you, or you could cut the interview short or whatever.
Yeah.
But what Musk is saying is anybody can say anything. Anybody can do anything. and he is not held accountable and he is not responsible. And for him and people like Farage to say that Keir Starmer is the biggest threat to freedom of speech in the history of the world, which is what they said the other day. Yeah. I mean, how you can say that when you have Putin in Russia, Xi Jinping in China, you know, North Korea, and he says Keir Starmer is the biggest threat to freedom of speech. I mean, for God's sake.
And you'll always see his message, won't you? Because the algorithm used to push your message to your followers. It doesn't do that anymore.
No, absolutely. I mean, when I go into... I've got to be honest, I'm using Twitter less and less, but when I go on, almost always the first thing I see is something about Musk or something about Farage and reform. I mean, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Because they're pushed because it causes attraction and that's how they make their money.
Correct.
Are you following politics in Ireland, by the way, Alistair?
Always.
Yeah, the hot topic here is, well, it seems to be the fortunes of Sinn Féin, where they were riding high in the polls. They were kind of on course to be in our next government, and our election could happen any moment between now and March. But there were local and European elections here, and they were almost half of what the polls were expecting them to do. Where do you see the direction if you're watching Sinn Féin?
Well, it's very hard. I mean, that sort of volatility that you're talking about is not just common to Ireland. I mean, look what's happened in America. I remember David Axelrod, who was, you know, one of Obama's strategy team. And I remember once talking to him and he said, the thing about politics is the conventional wisdoms are almost always wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not quite true. So the conventional wisdom in our country was Labour were going to win and win quite big. And they did. The conventional wisdom a few weeks ago in America was that Trump is nailed on. Yeah. Now the conventional wisdom is that Kamala Harris is nailed on.
Yeah.
The conventional wisdom in Ireland a few months ago was Sinn Féin, you know, on the move. North and South, the conventional wisdom now less so. I think that what happens is that if you take, let's just take the, what happened with Labour in the UK is that the more that people looked at Labour, as they were looking at a Tory government that they felt had failed, the more the people that looked at Labour, they thought, yeah, I can see them as the government. The question, I guess, is being asked in Ireland is Sinn Féin has its support, which is, you know, it's got a pretty solid support. People who are absolutely committed to Sinn Féin as a party and as a cause, and that's going to stay there. Where they were moving in the polls was people looking at them thinking, yeah, I quite like them. They look a bit more moderate than they used to be. They look a bit more different. They're sort of distancing themselves from the violence of the past, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then what happens is that as people start to think of them less as a sort of protest vote or less as an opposition, more, can I see these guys in government, then the expectations become harder, and the expectations become harder to meet. And I think what Sinn Féin have struggled with, I think, is to essentially rid themselves of the elements of populism that have helped them get to the point that they've got to. Mm-hmm. If they're going to get, you know, if they're going to be part of government, they've actually got to start operating and behaving like a government.
Yeah, I think that's part of their issue, though, that they've kind of moved so far to the centre in the last few years that people have sort of, they've started to lose their base or something. It's not quite clear because, again, polls are not really believable anymore because they keep underestimating. We have had two referendums as well that were badly forecast by polls. And again, in America, they're kind of half celebrating the Democrats. It's kind of the same worldwide, isn't it, when it comes to polls? They're celebrating that Kamala Harris is leading in those swing states at the moment, but polls have consistently underestimated Trump support.
Yeah, well, the other thing that happened, I think, in our election is that people didn't want to admit publicly that they were going to vote Tory or reform. You know, some did, but there's and I think it's, I suspect it's the same with Trump. Look, I do think Kamala Harris is in a, is currently in a good place. It strikes me that I think I love Joe Biden, but I think he did the right thing stepping down. There were doubts about whether she could step up, but she has stepped up, and she's not put a foot wrong.
Well, she hasn't spoken to any journalists, so how could she? She hasn't answered a question anyone.
But there's more to campaigning than talking to the media. I mean, you know, a campaign is about. It's about energy. It's about momentum. It's about, you know, I mean, just look at, I know I hate the money in American politics, but it is a huge factor. Just look at the money that they're raising since she stepped in.
Twice what Trump has raised in that period. Yeah. It's about the vibe, isn't it, for Americans?
It's partly about the vibe. What happens then is that, listen, there will be moments. There's going to be debate on September 10th. I'm sure she'll do interviews, but if you're, you know, the thing about American campaigns, they're very different to our campaigns. They tend to be very much about the big events, the big moments. And thus, you know, so if we, this, I'll be honest, I wasn't going to go to the convention. But then once the change happened, I started to get a bit more excited about it. I thought, you know, I really want to be there. So Rory Stewart and I are both going to go, and we're going to do the podcast from there next week. And, you know, that, you call it the vibe, but it's a sense of energy, momentum. And then it's also about the issues that you alight upon. And there's a very good piece, I don't know if you read The Hill, which is sort of, you know, Washington-based website and newspaper thing. And but they had a very interesting piece today about how Trump's just become boring all of a sudden. Trump was the guy who was really interesting. He's just become boring. He's saying the same old stuff. He's offensive about Kamala Harris the whole time. And it's just a boring shtick. Whereas what's happened with Kamala Harris and Tim Walz is that they're suddenly really interesting.
They look happy to be there as well, don't they?
They don't need to take big risks.
They look happy to be there. There's a kind of a sense of cheer around them, whereas Trump seems to be in the dumps at the moment.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and I, look, elections are very generally, elections are battles between hope and fear. Trump just does the fear. And I thought the thing that Walz said in his, you know, his first speech after she appointed him vice presidential nominee, and he said, you know, thank you for bringing the joy back. And, right. You know, I'm in France at the moment. I was up at the Olympics. And, I mean, it's a similar thing where there was just a mood in Paris that you haven't seen for years. Mm. And once that takes hold, it can be very, 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 very powerful because it changes the way that people think. And I think what Kamala Harris has done is changed the way that a lot of people think.
Absolutely. By the way, before I let you go, I hope you're well, because I know you've spoken about your own depression and that tangle of thought that goes on in your brain over the years.
I'm OK. I'm OK. I've had a bit of a, I've had a good run. I've had a few physical health issues, which were always a pain. I've got issues with my voice, which is a bit difficult when you make a living out of your bloody voice. But no, I've been good. I'm still on the pills, and I'm still talking to the right people. But I've been pretty good.
Very good. Are you still in touch with your old friend, Mr. Blair?
Indeed, I am. He's a very fine man, and I suspect we'll be in touch for the rest of our days.
Do you ever discuss Iraq?
We do. Yeah, we do. We do. And we, you know, not least in the context of today, but yeah, obviously we do. And
with regret, I presume.
Say again?
With regret, I presume.
Well, I mean, I always defend Tony, as I've said. I think I've said on your station before that when you've sat alongside somebody who's making a decision as big as that, and you've seen the care with which he's taken that decision, I still support him. I don't pretend that things worked out as well as we wanted them to, nor that do I pretend that mistakes weren't made. But I have to. Too often, people look at politicians and think that they can do politics in hindsight. You can't do politics and government in hindsight. You do it based on what you know, based on what you think you know, based on what you're being told, and based on your instincts and judgment. Mm. And I will support Tony for the rest of my days on it.
Although most of the world did say, with foresight, that it would be a disaster. And it was.
Well, some did, some didn't. I mean, if you look at the sort of big... Yes, Chirac did. Yes, Robin Cook did. You know, if I look at the Conservative Party that liked to pretend they were nowhere near the scene at the time, their big criticism of us was that we took too long to go in and sort it out. So, again, I would say that's a judgment that's passed with the benefit of hindsight.
It's an extraordinary legacy because you have that kind of tangle between peace in the North but war in the Middle East. What extraordinary times you lived through.
Well, it is. I think that if you're a... I would say that post-war, Attlee, Thatcher, Blair are probably the three really big change prime ministers. And Attlee's legacy is seen as overwhelmingly positive. Mm. Thatcher's legacy is seen as very, very mixed. And Tony's is mixed. But I would argue that for Tony, I think Northern Ireland and Kosovo in particular put him in the A-League of British prime ministers alone. When I look at the state of Britain today and the state of our public services compared with how they were when we left office, I think that puts him into the top flight. I think how Britain felt about itself during that period. I mentioned the Olympics. I think London 2012 was the last time that Britain truly felt kind of united and strong.
Good point, yeah.
And I think a lot of that was a legacy of a decade of New Labour. So I think, Tony, you know, and then I can reel off the policy stuff, you know, the minimum wage, the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Parliament, gay rights, freedom of information. I mean, I can go on and on about the changes we've made.
You're still the spin man. You're the spin dude at heart.
Yeah, maybe, but some things, you know, I do believe it.
Things are much more important than war, and that's football. And someone's saying, because you've Burnley FC is your beloved, I believe. Someone's asking, are you aware of a young Luke McNally who's the pride of County Meath?
Yes, I am, and he came on very briefly the other night as a substitute.
Yeah. So you're watching him as well. You don't miss anything.
He's a good
player. That's from Tom and Toronto.
We've had some great Irish players down the years, north and south. But I think that, listen, we started off the season with a 4-1 win, so I'll tell you that.
You could talk even more about that. Listen, I love chatting to you. Thanks a million, Alistair Campbell. Alistair Campbell Talks Politics. That's the book for secondary school kids, Why Politics Matters for Primary School Age. They're out now, published by Redshed. We'll be back after the break.
Email Oliver at rte.ie.
35 Irish athletes will be taking part in the Paralympic Games, which starts on the 28th of August until the 8th of September. And our guests this morning are both former Paralympians, are going to be commentating on some of the events for RT Sport. They're cyclist Peter Ryan, who's in studio. Good morning, Peter.
Morning, Oliver.
And runner Michael McKillop, he's on the phone, and we'll come to Michael shortly. Peter, you're very welcome to the studio here. When did you take part in the Paralympics?
I was at the 2016 Rio Games, so... But involved, I suppose, in Paralympic sport for a good 8 to 9 years on the kind of high performance world championship side of things. So,
and you're a proud Tipperary man.
I am indeed, yeah.
You were a hurler. Was that your kind of first interest in sport?
Yeah, once upon a time, I suppose, before disability kicked in, I would have played a lot of hurling, football, soccer. Very, I suppose, quintessential Tipperary upbringing. Reared with a hurley in your hand. But
if you're not on a horse, you need a hurley in your
hand. Basically, yeah, something to that effect. So yeah, no, that shaped me and life was good.
Were you good at hurling?
I'm getting better the more longer I'm retired, Oliver. I was playing at a decent level, I suppose. Yeah, I played with Tip underage and played as high as I could at the time. But would I have went on? Who knows? But yeah, it kind of gets romanticised a little just because... I suppose when a thing gets taken away from you.
I know. People, what age were you when it was?
I was 19, 20. So, you're in the prime. I was playing senior at the club. I wore blue and gold a few times. Life was good. So, like I say, it's easy lament, and it's one of the things that, can make you bitter. You can say, oh, I could have done this, I could have done that. But, I played soccer at a high level as well. I was delusional. I was telling myself I should have been in the Premiership. It's who knows where I'd have been.
Yeah, but you have to believe those things, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And look, it's part of the hurt, and it stops you kind of dealing with it because you start wishing and comparing and contrasting and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, got back into sport. And it
what,
was a
what
big,
happened to you?
What from a disability point of view or getting back in? So I lost 80 to 90% of my eyesight. I got a condition, Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. And... yeah, I was 19, 20, so it was a big game changer. Working in building sites, playing sport, driving cars, very normal life, and then had to obviously do a bit of a flip. And that wasn't, it's too simplistic, say it took a quick turn and went the other way.
Devastating.
Yeah, I gave 2-3 years trying to figure this out and trying to get my head around it. And I suppose there is no getting your head around it, but eventually you have to start moving on though and start parking certain things and talking about other things. And Joe Emily touched on a lot of, I suppose, there'd be there in the previous interview, there'd be a lot of commonalities there and talking about your story, just getting and moving on. And yeah, found sport, and that was probably the first big domino in me kind of reinventing myself.
Look at you now, coming from Paralympics and talking with others. But what went on in the 3 years? How did you cope with it, or what did you do?
Oh, young Irish man, I drank on it, I didn't talk, I pushed people away. I was the worst iteration of myself for about a good 2 years. But like I said, good people, good support networks. Like, talk about country Ireland and laughing about the hurley in the hand. But I also had huge support networks in that. I had people that I was best friends with from 5 years of age that were all, they could see I wasn't happy. They were there trying to help and ready to pick you up when you were ready to kind of grab that hand. So yeah, I was very, very fortunate in a lot of ways. And the penny ultimately dropped, and I kind of got back into sport. That was the one I said, do you know what, I'm going to try use sport as that first little piece to reinvent myself.
And I think you were in college, were you, when you came upon the Paralympics and the idea behind it?
Yeah, I was. Well, do you know what, it was one of these things, huge hang up about Paralympics and disability sport. And that was part of my acceptance journey. And like, that's not me, because I grew up able-bodied for whatever that means. And do you know what I mean? So I didn't identify with that world. And like I said, through talking, counselling, a lot of that kind of stuff, I realised, oh, I need to get back into sport and drop some of these hang-ups that I have and whatever. But it came about, they were running an open day up in UCD. Paralympics were having a come and try event type thing. And I just went very open mind, said, do you know what, I want to find a five-a-side game of soccer, some visually impaired lads, bust one of them up against the wall, think that I'm being myself again, try and get that sense of what I used to have.
Yeah.
And the whole thing just snowballed. I got taught into different sports, and the cycling squad told them about my background. I was telling them all the positive stuff. I wasn't telling them about what I'd been getting up to for a few years.
And good, good.
Yeah. But yeah, bit of potential here. And do you know what it was? I suppose I actually think the reason it became sustainable, I never cycled, and it was a whole new experience, and everything about it was a new lease of life and new shape on everything. And before I knew it, I was winning national titles and getting asked, would you get involved in a high performance squad and go to a world championships in Canada? And I was like, when you put down three utterly depressing years, and then all of a sudden a year later, a year and a half, this stuff is happening. You just go with it. I wasn't thinking games, I wasn't thinking big picture. I was just smiling, and I was like, yeah, let's do more of this.
Do you nearly have to go through 3 years of misery to understand how good life can be?
I think it would have been strange not to, do you know that? And I kind of think there has, like, maybe it happened instantaneously with me where I just kind of devolved pretty quickly, but like when it happened, but like, I think for it to happen, for you to transition too smoothly, I think it's going to happen eventually. Like, you have to, kind of have to go through that grief. It's like, I was shedding who I was, and there was an awful lot that goes with that. So I think after, whether you have to or not, who knows, but I think once you have done that, you do appreciate everything and you savour it, and you might say you savour every moment, but until you've kind of been in that rock bottomy place, you jump, who's to say what savouring it really is like.
Everything gets better. Yeah. But your story just tells us the story of the Paralympics, doesn't it? I mean, how important this is. And I'd imagine how ecstatic that is to perform, represent your country, having gone through what you went through at the Paralympics in Rio in 2016.
Yeah, like I laugh. Like, I was in a treatment centre in 2012. I was in the Olympic Village in 16. I was like, these are very two different institutional buildings. But like it was that journey in that 4 year span, like it was huge. It's huge for me. But the Paralympics as a whole, yeah, like you said, we're all high off the back of the Olympics and the fever pitch, but like you sprinkle in the disability element, you sprinkle in the life story, and we're actually only talking about backstage because, look, fortunate enough, going doing a bit of punditry for the games coming up. But it's like, what are people interested in? And they like the backstories, they like the who the person is when they're not a world champion, because sometimes that stuff is hard to identify with. But you're a normal lad from here, and you're this, and you're like, Joe, you know, I think that's the stuff that people really want to see, is like the human element. And the Paralympics is just like very human.
It is. And you're a cyclist.
Yeah, cycling, running. I retired in 2020 from the cycling scene. Doing a lot of running the last few years, but yeah, I suppose I identify as a cyclist.
Yeah. But that's what you did in Rio, and it's tandem cycling.
Tandem
isn't
cycling,
it?
Yeah.
So is this, I think you describe it, don't you, as like the rowing teams that we're used to seeing at the Olympics?
Yeah, because the dynamic is, you're an individual athlete, but it's a team sport within an individual sport. I was saying it before, like you throw in the disability element, like Paul O'Donovan can get out of that team boat and win a world championships on his own. Right. Essentially a visually impaired blind athlete, he's so reliant on that guy in the front, because it's like, it's empowering him to be the best cyclist he can be. And but yes, you know, he's putting everything into it. It's a real rare team, and you sprinkle in, I always say, like, we go in a training camp, you're visually impaired, so you're probably reliant on that person. You're going around 24/7. The dynamic is a super rare sporting one where, like, without him, you don't even get to compete. You hardly get to train without that person. So it's, do you know, but at the end of the day, the bike runs better with two people on it. It's it gives an individual sport, like you say, like sometimes it stops being about you. It's easier to fight for someone else in life. Joe, and I, like,
I know what you mean.
I often, yeah, like Joe, me and Sean, any of the guys I raced with would have had a real tight relationship with him. And like, you probably want to quit last 3K into a 100-mile race. Do you know what I mean? They can be tough events. They can be, but like sometimes you just, or when it comes to going training, it's like, well, I know he's doing it. It's an accountability, but it's like, it's
ever just you. Yeah, it's, yeah, harder maybe sometimes to show up.
Well, that was my biggest, like going from team sports to an individual sport. That was a hard transition because like, I've played really well on a team and lost. I've played really bad and the team won. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, whereas
in you'll always have the lads around.
Yeah, whereas in an individual sport, I don't play well. I probably don't do well. Do you know what, yeah, I mean?
I see what you
so
mean,
it's,
yeah.
Yeah.
I want to bring in Michael McKillop, who's on the line. Good morning, Michael.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Another Paralympian. Give us your history, because you've done a few games, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm privileged and lucky enough to represent the island in four Paralympic Games. I started my journey in Beijing in 2008 and retired in, just after Tokyo in 2001 or in 2021. So for me, it was a long journey and an amazing journey, and one that has fabulous memories, and I've met amazing people along the way.
And you have the medals to show for it as well.
Yeah, like I said, it's been a privilege to represent my country, and I think winning four medals, yes, it's amazing for me, but as Peter said, like it's the people around you, it's the team around you that have helped me, and yes, I'm an individual sport, but if it wasn't for my coach, my father, if it wasn't for my physio, what strength and conditioning coaches, the chef de mission in all the games that I attended, the structure, the managers, you know, James Nolan, who's still the manager of the athletics team, like it wouldn't have been possible. So I'm very, very lucky and blessed to have had the life, the privileged life that I've led. And I'm really excited to watch the Paralympic Games coming up in 2 weeks' time.
And you mentioned your dad was a coach. He kind of wanted to push you a little bit, didn't he, when you were younger?
Yeah, I think, well, for me, my life with a disability started at birth, and my diagnosis was 2 years and 10 months. And I think we learned, he learned a lot from having a disabled child. No parent in this world wants to have a child with a disability, but they used it alongside my mother, used it as a positive and tried to encourage me into every single thing that they possibly could. And they used sport as my physiotherapy at the time. And I grew up in a little town called Cushendall on the north coast of Antrim, and at the hurling town. And my dad was involved in the local hurling scene at the time, and kind of that was my first love. And then running took over from that because my father was a runner in his day. And I think you just want to follow in the footsteps of the people that your role models are, the people you look up to. And for me, that was my mom and dad, who were both athletes. And I think you naturally fall into the thing that you kind of feel passionate about. And I'm very blessed and lucky enough to have fallen into a sport that allowed me to travel the world and give me those medals and give me those moments of standing on the podium and hearing Ron Levien and I'm walking away and seeing the smiles and the atmosphere that I created from winning that medal.
I mean, you've had extraordinary success. You have two gold medals, don't you? And a very unusual moment. Your mother got to present you with one of them.
Yeah, I luckily enough, I have four medals. So,
four goals, sorry.
Yeah, four from four games, but one in three games. I won double gold in London, like you kind of had said about my mother. And
yeah,
she had the lucky special moment to hand over an Olympic or Paralympic gold medal to me. And she was the first mother to ever present her child with an Olympic or a Paralympic gold medal.
What a moment.
And for me, that goes down as in my personal opinion, for me, the greatest moment of my career, because it was a moment of showing to the world that parents are vital to anyone with a disability. And they're the rock. And I think my mom had won because her son had accomplished so much. And she still is the only parent that's had that privilege of presenting their child with an Olympic or Paralympic gold medal. And for me, that will go down in history. And, oh, yeah, and she's a very special woman.
totally, totally unique. Michael, you also are very optimistic, aren't you, about the world and how we're changing, and we have the language and the vernacular and the attitude towards people with disability and visibility for them.
Yeah, 100%. And I think when you look at the bigger picture, we've had such an amazing Olympic Games. We've had amazing Olympic Games in the past, but to follow up and then the accomplished games in its whole, the Paralympic Games come off the back of the Olympic Games. And for me, it's a great opportunity to showcase 35 other elite athletes from this island at the biggest elite stage at the Paralympic Games. And we've had so many amazing accomplishments and medals from the Olympic Games this time round. And it's now, the way I look at it, Paralympics Ireland and the athletes of Paralympics, they got to step up to the plate. They got to show the nation that they're good enough to compete at the elite level. And I'm sure 100% that they're going to go out there and do the best they can and definitely bring some medals. But the most important thing is for the nation to get behind these athletes. Yes. And I think that for me is what I experienced getting more and more the older I became. So in 2008, it was a very small amount of people that would have recognized the Paralympic movement. But in Tokyo, you started to see the nation get behind the Paralympians. And I think it's now, when it's closer to home, it's in Paris, you're going to see a lot more Irish people with a lot of tricolours in the stadiums and getting the opportunity to travel to a major games. I think it's 100% now the time to really get behind and use the Olympics as the bounce and that we really need to see another group of athletes going and doing the best they can and win medals.
Well, it's going to be really special. It's going to be special for both of you, Peter and Michael, because you're going to be doing the punditry, the commentating for the first time. So this is a new experience. And Peter, you can come in this conversation as well, because we're looking ahead to these athletes. They've only got 2 more weeks left of preparation. Some of them are household names. Who should we be looking out for?
Well, definitely cycling-wise, I think Eve McChrystal and Katie, they'll be on the tandem female bike. Like, if she has a good game, she could come away with 3 medals.
Really?
Like, yeah, but she definitely wants that one in the time trial, road race time trial type setup. So, like, again, she's on the scene since London. This is going to be her 4 games. Who knows how many more are left. I think athletes become a bit more conscious when they're starting to get that stage. They want to take everything that's on the table. Mm-hmm. There's no, when you're young, you think this is going to last forever. I'm sure Michael can attest to that. And you think when you start getting to those final games, you know, right, you know, who knows what's ahead. So every race matters. And those ladies definitely have every chance of representing. So, but like that, the games throw up crazy results too, because without getting, and Michael chime in here away, but without getting too into it, like, you've world championships, you have every nation sends all their best athletes, but say the way qualification points go, some of the events are smaller than others, typically at the games, just due to the amount of medals, this, that and the other. So, like, it's just going to throw up some crazy results, or there's going to be a young kid on the block that's just starting to come on the scene now,
of course,
who
yeah.
wasn't there 2 years ago. Yeah. You throw in Ronan Grimes, great friend of mine. He's the world champion from 2022 in cycling. Like, he's a great chance of meddling in a road race. But I know there's been some reclassification of athletes in his event. So all of a sudden he went from being a world champion to now having new competition that he didn't even have last year on the scene. So it's like I say, there's a whole nuance to the disability piece as well. But I think they'll be hoping to try and do equal at least what the able-bodied games do. But Michael, you might have your pulse on the athletic scene a bit more than me.
Yeah, for me, across all sports, we have amazing opportunities of medals. We've got world champions, we've got European champions, we've got people that have just missed out on medals in Tokyo and other games. But for me, obviously, in the athletics, we have 5 going. 2 stalwarts, which is Greta Stream and Keita, and then Ora Comerford. Like I said, Greta's been to 2 Paralympic Games so far and has finished 4th in both times. And Ora, unfortunately, hasn't had the best track record at Paralympic Games. Unfortunately, she's picked up a little knocks and niggles in Rio and in Tokyo. But these are the games where I believe Orla's going to come out of her shell and go to the next level. She's
great.
3rd in the world currently on time. She's just recently come out of a block of hard training in the build-up to these games. She broke 12 seconds for the 100 metres for the first ever time this season. And I think this is really her step, and this is an opportunity for her. But the likes of Mary Fitzgerald, who finished seventh in Tokyo, she's, I think, ranked higher than that now in the world. And you never know an outside chance of a medal. But even when you really put it in perspective, even like looking at the swimmers,
Ellen's
going to her fifth Paralympic Games.
It's Ellen Keane, yes, we all know her.
Ellen Keane, fifth Paralympic Games. She's won two medals. She's won a bronze in Rio. She's won a gold in Tokyo. And this is going to be her last Paralympic Games. So what a way it would go, amazing way to go out than winning a medal and saying goodbye, au revoir, whatever you want to say to elite sport at the Paralympic level. And then it would be amazing. And then obviously you've got the minority sports, as we would probably call. You've got the para-equestrian, or you've got the powerlifting. We've got a junior world champion from 2017. And then I guess...
That's Brittany, isn't it?
For me personally.
And she's on a roll.
And then the last... Yeah, and then the last, I personally believe, has a great opportunity would be Katie O'Brien, who is a rower. She comes from the same training group as the O'Donovan brothers, and she has a new partner, Tiernan. They're both world medalists in the build-up to these games. So I'm personally looking forward to these games and seeing it from a different perspective, because all I've had to do over my career is talk about myself and focus on myself and focus on the medals I want to win. But now it's going to be an amazing opportunity alongside other athletes and being pundits for RTE and like Peter said, like showcasing that to the nation and trying to get people engaged and telling the stories and hopefully get to hear Ron Levine a couple of times, and that would be very, very special.
Yeah, we look forward to listening to you both. Peter, can I ask you, obviously you're going to be commentating or doing punditry. How will it be described to you, or how do you find out what's going on?
Like most things in my life, Oliver, I'm going to figure it out as I go along the way. I've been asked to do a little bit of co-com stuff, and like, yeah, obviously there is an elephant in the room here, but I'm like, I think if I'm just kind of following the cues of the actual commentator, I'm like, you know, I think if I took on maybe a little bit of a different role, like you were just talking about David Gillick there beforehand, but a lot of the real insight is personal experience. And like, once you can give that tidbit of even a mindset, what someone's going through, like you say, like listening to Michael there, like I think like a factor we haven't spoke about in the games is like a lot of these athletes are in Tokyo with no crowds. We go to Paralympic events, which aren't as well followed, let's call it spade a spade, as some of the able-bodied world championships. Yeah. Like, there's going to be huge crowds in Paris. Mm-hmm. That's going to throw up murky results. Someone's going to react.
It affects things, for sure.
I think, like, from that point of view, I've played at high levels. I think I can, you know, add my own little tidbits here and there. So
yeah, and a lot of punditry and commentary was to do with hearing the interviews afterwards, and because that was the most fascinating thing. Because often we complain about sports stars not really, they're so coached that we don't hear the emotions or their personalities. It was different in the Olympics, we just heard. So presumably that's going to be the same.
I think so. And the mix zone is a great, like, it's brilliant when you're like on top and like obviously, but just getting that raw emotion and like you get to see the real side of it and what they've went through. So I think, look, the games, Michael said it himself, it's thrown a light on sports that we're not looking at all year round. So really, and there's that extra piece of, like say, the disability story, the backdrop, what it means to parents. Like, I think it's going to cover a multitude. Like, so
you're well qualified.
Just, yeah, we're asking people to just get in behind it and see what happens.
Tune in from the 28th
of August. I'll make a show of myself, don't say.
Well, please do make a show of yourself. That's half the entertainment. But don't be boring. I don't think you will, because that's often the complaint with punditry. But it has been good in the Olympics. It was a complaint during the Euros. But the Olympics, people showed a lot of heart. Rob Heffernan, Sonia, David Gillick, and Michael. You're the same. You're on duty as well. So we want to hear emotion.
Yeah, 100%.
Have your stepbrother.
Yeah, 100%. But I'm like Peter said, obviously, it's calling spade a spade. I'm talking about performances and talking about good performances, bad performances, and obviously trying to be critical and positive in a lot of ways. But I think it's very important for the nation to see what these sports are and trying to convince them that it's enough to be engaged with them all year round and between the 4 years, and that's the one downfall of of kind of all media is the fact that it goes missing for 3 years before every Paralympic Games. Yeah. But if we can encourage the nation to get behind us, then you just never know. And I think looking at what the likes of Rob Heffernan does and Dervo Organ, Sonia O'Sullivan, David Gillick, like the amount of praise that David has got, and knowing David personally from my time on Ultimate Hell Week with him, he's a true gentleman and someone that really gets and understands what it is to be an Olympian, because he's been there and done that. Yeah. And I think that's also another thing is
has come
when
across,
you know what elite
sure.
sport is, it's easier to engage with people that are going through raw emotion of positivity, of excitement, but also for kind of the sad moments or the unfortunate moments of performance is not going the way
he was.
Want,
he was brilliant at that particular.
What we're trying
and,
Mike, to do.
And Michael, of course, you have a baby who's only turning one in September, so you'll be crying the whole way through anyway. From that point, congratulations for little Dunica. Yeah. Peter Ryan, you're recently married too, I believe. So congratulations,
indeed,
to you.
Yes,
we'll be listening out and watching out. Michael McKillop, thank you so much, and Peter Ryan, thanks a million, and we look forward to the Paralympic Games the 28th of August. We'll be just take a quick break.
Back email here. oliver@rte.ie.
Exciting news for you, because in 2 weeks' time, Paris and France are going to host their first ever Paralympic Summer Games. It's Wednesday, the 28th of August, Place de la Concorde, where the heads were lopped off, and the Champs-Élysées will be the most beautiful avenue in the world, you could say. It's going to be the stage for this incredible celebration. It will be magnifique, and today this programme, in association with Team Ireland, are announcing who will be the flag bearers at that event, representing us, the Irish nation, at the opening ceremony. They will be Orla Comerford, who is a runner, and table tennis player Colin Judge. He's ranked in the world top 10, no less. And Colin Judge joins us now on the line. Congratulations, Colin.
Thank you, Oliver. And thanks very much for having me here today.
Not all that. It's brilliant news. And I presume you were online like myself looking at the opening ceremony. Have you seen the route and everything? And
no, it's absolutely incredible. I've been glued to the Olympics and I'm just really, really looking forward to getting out there myself now.
And you're going to be the flag bearer along with Orla. When did you find out the news?
I found out on Tuesday and I was over the moon. It's a massive honour for me to carry the flag of the country that I love so much and represent my teammates alongside Orla Comerford on the biggest stage. It's going to be really special, and I'm just very grateful to PI for the opportunity.
That's Paralympics Ireland. And it's going to be a wonderful event. As I say, it's on that famous avenue from Place de la Concorde. They have sort of videos online. They have mocking up what it's going to look like. Who's going to join you? Have you got family and friends going over to Paris to watch you?
Yeah, a lot of family and friends. I'm really, really excited. You know, that was obviously the one thing with Tokyo, that there was no crowds. And, you know, to be able to share the experience this time with my family and friends, it's really special. And I'm just really looking forward to it, and hopefully I can put in a good performance for them.
Well, you have in the past, so there'll be no bother to you. You must have included, because you have the benefit of having watched the Olympics, and it's going to be in the same arena, isn't it, the table tennis?
Yes, that's right, yeah. The Paris South Arena, it looks like a fantastic setup they have there.
They've kind of beautiful historic buildings and so on. But give us an idea of your Paralympian trip so far to date, because you have quite a few medals already.
Yeah. Well, it started back in 2012 when I made my international debut. That was a long time ago. And I remember then going to London 2012 with my dad. And that was kind of the moment I decided that I wanted to be a Paralympian too. So 2016, I narrowly missed out by the Rio Paralympic Games by one place. Which was really, really tough at the time. But I came good the following year. Then I won the European Championships in 2017. Mm-hmm. So I was the first Irish player to ever do that, and you know, then I had my sights set on Tokyo 2020, but there was a few obstacles along the way. I was reclassified in 2018, which was very tough. It meant that my ranking was went from 5 to 39, so well outside the qualification criteria for Tokyo. Right. And it was at that point then that I decided to go full time and give it everything. And COVID, obviously, it was a disaster for most people, but the game has been postponed by a year, sort of gave me a little bit of extra time. And
really?
Thankfully, I qualified for Tokyo, so I have that experience behind me. And since then, in the new class, I've won a bronze medal in the European Championships last year. So that was my first time on the podium
well
in my
done.
New classification. And I've a silver medal in Czech from about 6 weeks ago, so I'm on form. And
that's the Czech
now
Open.
I'll see my Yeah, the Czech Open in June. So that was my most recent one. So yeah, I'm on form, and obviously my big goal now is Paris 24.
And you want to be on the podium?
Yeah, that's my goal. You know, I've beaten a lot of the players in the top eight, and you know, I'm currently ranked 10th in the world. So you know, there's no reason why I've mixed it with the best now for the last few years. And you know, preparation has been really good. You know, much better than last time. I qualified a lot earlier, and I'm currently in camp on the sports campus. So I'm training really hard and doing everything I can to make sure I put in a good performance and give myself the best chance.
And so you mentioned you're a full-time athlete now. What was the job that you were, what did you spend your time doing before that?
Yeah, so I worked as an actuary in KPMG for about 3 years up until the point that I was reclassified. And I suppose it was at that point then that I knew it, like I wasn't going to reach my potential if I was working long hours and trying to train in the evening. So I made a tough decision at the time. You know, I wanted to reach my best level, and it was the only way that I felt that I could compete in my new class. I felt that I was out of my depth in the beginning, and you know, I haven't really looked back since then. I've been a full-time athlete, and you know, I've moved up a long way. I'm into the top 10 now, so not quite where I was in class 2, but I'm on my way and on the up, and just really looking forward now to test myself on the big stage.
You're an actuary, so you're mad with brains as well.
I wouldn't say that. I like maths.
You do? I presume works for table tennis, does it, in some way?
Yeah, well, it's very much a mental game, table tennis, and that's why I love it. It's such a complicated sport, and there's so many different ways of playing, so many different styles, and tactics is hugely important. So we've been talking a lot about that the last few weeks. We don't know who my opponent is, so the draw will be made 2 or 3 days before my event, and it'll be direct knockout. So obviously, you have to be prepared to play anyone.
Is there no repechage that we became familiar with in the Olympics?
No, unfortunately not. If you lose, it's game over and you're out. So it's a very unforgiving system, but you know, I think that it's the way that it should be. It's very exciting, and yeah, there's no room for error. You have to be ready from the first ball, and that's what I plan to be. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, and the 2nd of September, that's when you begin. The Paralympics are really massive, aren't they, for disabled athletes and getting visibility. We were chatting to Michael McKillop and Peter Ryan the other day, who are going to be the pundits for RTE, and just the progress since it was Beijing in the case of Michael McKillop, and just the visibility and the excitement around these games.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. You know, like I said, I went to London 2012 with my dad, and I was just absolutely blown away by, you know, how much attention the Paralympics got, and rightfully so. And, you know, I think it's even come on from there, and I've no doubts that Paris 2024, they're going to put on an amazing show, and I'm just really looking forward to being a part of it.
Fantastic. Also, they're amazing stories, all the Paralympians, because Peter Ryan was here, he was fine until he started losing his sight in his teenage years. You were born with your disability, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was born with one arm and no leg, so I don't know any other way. I've grown up like with a disability, and you know, I think that was what the amazing thing about table tennis was for me, like, that I struggled a lot with my disability in my teenage years, and table tennis gave me an outlet and a passion and a goal. And you know, since then I've never really looked back, and the success that I've achieved in table tennis has definitely translated to other areas in my life.
Really? In what way?
Well, academically, I suppose. I wasn't great at the books from a young age either. And, you know, when I started to, you know, set goals for myself in table tennis and achieve those goals, it kind of gave me the belief that I could apply myself to other areas in life. And yeah, I was then around transition year that I set my sights on actuarial and financial studies, which was a big goal at the time.
Yeah.
It was one of the toughest courses in the country to get into. And
massive
points. Thankfully, got in there and graduated 4 years later.
Is that one of those over 500 points in the Leaving Cert?
Yeah, it definitely is. It was a tough one. I had to work very hard, but I suppose being good at the maths helped me a lot, and the extra bonus points didn't do any harm either.
600 points in Leaving Cert are close enough to, is what I'm being told. So you're right. Yeah. You're mad with brains. But listen, I hope you really enjoyed. By the way, you're in action tonight, are you, in the National Indoor Arena?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. We're doing two wheelchair matches. It's a little bit of a dry run for Paris 2024. So I've been training really hard, and I'm going to have a short session now and just prepare like a competition. It's great to have the competitive practice because I don't have much of that in Ireland. So it'll be a brilliant event. So if anyone is in the area and not doing anything, I'd be very happy to have them in the crowd. The more the merrier. We're trying to create an atmosphere that would be some way similar to Paris 24. So yeah, I've been training really hard and I'm looking forward to competing tonight.
Listen, you're going to have an absolutely incredible time over in Paris. We've seen the Irish in action already. They were just warming up. September the 2nd, you're in action, but we'll be watching out Wednesday the 28th of August. Colin Judge, our flag bearer, Irish flag bearer, along with runner Orla Comerford. Good luck and enjoy it, Colin.
Thanks very much for having me, Oliver. I'll
Not
do my
at
best.
All. Not at all. You're very, very welcome. Thanks so much. 51551 is the text. We'll be back after these. 51551, by the way, is to get involved in this conversation about, well, what it's like to transition from the primary school into the secondary school bit. I'm joined in studio by Shira Mishra. Is it Mishra or Mishra, by the way?
Shreya Mishra.
Shreya Mishra. And Keane Birmingham. You're both very welcome. You're both 16 years of age?
Yeah.
But you don't do you know each other through Corley Nanogue, which is the thing you're involved in? Oh, yeah, very good. You do know each other. Shira, you got in touch with us to tell us about this event that yourself and Keane are doing. Well, tell us about, first of all, the what Corley Nanogue is, because I'm not hugely familiar with it.
Corley Nanogue is a youth-led organisation to promote the youth voice in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. So each county council has a Corley Nanogue, which is for young people to join and get their youth voice heard in the area and bring out their views on different issues that young people are facing.
Very good. So it's a county by county basis. We can't separate ourselves from the edge. And are you from Wicklow or Dublin? Are you in school in Wicklow or what's?
I'm in school in Wicklow.
Very good.
So I'll be going to St. David's Grace Jones this year. And but I'm part of DLR Corley Nanogue. So in DLR Corley Nanogue, we use
Dunleary Rathdown.
Dunleary Rathdown. That county council, yes.
And that's what you do. And Keane, you're from?
I'm from Shankill and I go to school in Cabin Teely.
Very good.
Yeah.
And you're involved in the GA as well there?
Yeah, I am, in Shankill. Yeah,
we're just getting to know you.
Yeah, get me in there.
Is Shankill, is that a football, rugby or football hurling club?
It's
or
a football hurling, yeah, football
it's
hurling.
I suppose. Yeah, it's one of those Dublin clubs that has millions of teams.
It's a good club, yeah.
And are you a footballer or a hurler?
I'm a bit of both, but I'm more of a footballer than I am a hurler, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Posh parts of Dublin are into hurling, aren't they?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
We are, to be fair. Okay, just to make that clear. And but you go to school, not in Shankill, where do you go to school again?
Cabin Teely. School, yeah.
Okay, is that nearby then?
Only down the road, yeah. Only down the road.
Yeah, Dubs thing, everything is close.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
Until you get a bus.
Just down the road there.
Yeah. Okay, so and Corley Nanogue, that's what you get involved in. What do you do in Corley Nanogue?
So in Corley Nanogue, we have our meetings every month. Yeah. And we discuss the issue that we decide on during the September, November timeframe. So we usually have a youth conference every year. And in the youth conference, we get loads of young people together from the areas, from the Dunleary Rathdown area, from the different schools. And we get them together and we get them to vote on a topic. So our topic for this year is school stress. So once we decide on the topic, we discuss the topic for the entire year round and look at the different issues that young people are facing based on surveys we do and our research we do, and then look at the objectives we have for the year and then look at how to combat them and how to work them out and solve them.
Okay, and you're kind of honing in on this whole moving from primary to secondary. I'm guessing because you're 16 that you fell into that period 4 years ago in lockdowns and so on. Did you lose your primary school, the end of primary school? What happened?
So we would have, it was just after fifth class that we hit lockdown. So mid fifth class would have been when we first hit lockdown, and that was the first part of lockdown.
Yeah.
Keane, how do you realise now how that affected you, that whole thing? Losing the end of one school and the start of
100%, second? Yeah, I do, yeah. And even, I started, you're so distanced away from people, I started losing all my social skills and I kind of had to try and rebuild them in secondary school. And it's only within the past 3 years since I've been in secondary school that I've kind of rebuilt them back up and overcome my anxiety and just my fears and stuff with the unknown. So
what were you afraid of?
Just day to day kind of things, like meeting people. When I first went in the first year, I had a big fear of just mixing with people and trying to just be myself. I was always very scared, so I kind of over overcame that within the first year or two of secondary school.
Well, the first year or two? Like, yeah. That's a huge amount of time in a teenager's life, I imagine. Do you kind of know what helped you, what repaired you?
Just throwing yourself into everything you can was kind of the only thing that helped me. Just doing what you can and trying to put yourself outside your boundaries is kind of the best way to...
Were most of your friends in the same sort of boat?
Yeah, yeah. So I went to like I went to school and like where none of my primary friends kind of went. So I went into a completely different school where I didn't know anybody. So it was kind of like my biggest fear, but I tried to overcome that.
Yeah, so it was literally nobody from primary school you were in on in your own. And Shreya, what was your experience like?
I think walking into secondary school and everything's so new to you and then you're told you have to wear a mask is just so weird, you know? And then you can't see anyone's faces. You're walking into like this new place and that too, feeling like everyone's half covered and like you can't see anyone. So it feels like you're put through a black hole. But I think the same as Kian, like I think I got involved in a lot of things. So that kept me going, you know, even during those tough periods of time. Like, I know sixth class, it was like, you're not even seeing off your school in a really comfortable and normal way. You're kind of just like social distancing and, you know, all that's still there. And you're just, it's a really restricted format of going into something and getting out of something.
Yeah.
So I think that experience of being there and feeling really restricted was really constraining. And then as soon as everything was eased, the lockdown was eased, I think that impact on my mental health was like, oh, it feels much better, you know.
Was it kind of instant or?
It took a while. I think it took a week and then we got used to seeing the teacher's full face instead of the face. Yeah, because otherwise you just see the eyes and you'd be like, okay, so those eyes look like for that teacher. And it's like, they're anyways new people to you. So it takes a while. I think once it came to after December, so when the lockdown eased in 2021 into 2022, so January, I think it felt much better. We all kind of got more comfortable. And you get to do more things than in school as well. Because if there are loads of activities, half of them are cancelled. Why? Because you, like, if they're traditions from the past, half of them are cancelled. Because, due to COVID, we can't do this year.
Right.
So, like, all those traditions are kind of gone. So you miss a year of doing the fun things. So I think once the lockdown eased, it felt much better. And then we kind of got all going and full speed ahead. So it was a catch-up that we had to do.
It was a big catch-up.
Yeah.
Because going into secondary school is stressful anyway.
Yeah.
And obviously the intake that's coming in now in September, they're going from primary to secondary. They don't have all that pandemic stuff.
Yeah, it's a whole different kind of game.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing.
World.
Yeah.
What would you say to, they're about 13, isn't it? You're about 12,
about
13.
13 or 14 when you're entering the first year.
What would you say to those kids now? Since you're the big kids, they're going
Welcome
into.
Back. It's just like that, you're going to have that initial kind of anxiety. And I mean, from my experience of going into school, people didn't know. It's going to take a while to settle in. But you're going to have the support from your teachers, support from your school peers, and you're going to have that support just in general there from not only maybe from your parents, but just in general, you'll kind of get that after. You'll settle in eventually, you know what I mean?
Do you think it's a good idea when some schools, they let the first years go in on their own for a week or two and then the rest of the school arrives? Or is that too much of a shock to the system?
I think it's a good way. Like, at least they get familiarised to the school. But at the same time, I think asking people really helps, because if you have interaction with people and you ask them where you have to go, it makes, you're building a connection firstly with the inside of the school and with people in the school, as well as you kind of get to know the place much better because you remember, oh, that friend of mine told me where this is. So you kind of relate to things, and that I think helps. So my advice, if I were to give it to the first years coming in, stay relaxed. Nice. It's just, you know, another school year, and don't be hesitant to ask anyone, you know, because...
That's a hard thing to do, though, isn't it? When you're kind of terrified.
Or just, like, try to figure out a way rather than restricting yourself to saying, no, I can't do this, you know, don't give up.
You'll be grand.
You'll be grand.
Try to get the courage to ask people. Exactly. And they'll be more than happy to help. Mm-hmm. And plus, everyone else, probably, if you don't recognise people, they're probably in the same boat as you.
Yeah.
There will always be a group, obviously, you know each other and we'll hang around, but you know, they may not necessarily have been friends. Would you have done anything differently yourselves when you look back at the move?
I don't know. I think maybe what I might have done is that I might have sat down, made a group of friends that would have been other than my primary school friends, which is hard to do.
Oh, I see, because you came in with your primary school friends.
Yeah, so almost my entire class was with me. But what I do feel is that getting to know people who are not from your primary school can be really handy as well.
if you're the person who goes up to them, the people you don't know, are they going, oh God, here's the weird girl now.
I think,
there's a risk, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a risk. But at the same time, I think in the long term, it feels much better because then you get to know
You'd be good at that, I'd say. You're confident.
But I think for people who don't feel like doing that either, I think getting to know teachers is really nice. Yeah.
Would you have done anything differently? You were the opposite, obviously. You came in on your own, so you had to meet people.
Yeah. Well, I suppose like a cheese rage answer is like I wouldn't really, because I wouldn't really be where I am now. You know. So,
where are you, Kane? Yeah. What's so great about you?
No. If I was to go back and say to myself, just that goes away. You know what I mean? It all, you kind of settle in, but you have to try and see the person that you want to become.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you put your mind to it, you'll get there.
That's very profound. Someone's asking, can you ask your fantastic young guests, how do you join their organisation and how it is spelt? Oh. Ask Sinead in Dundalk, who has a father. I'm surprised now she doesn't know how to spell Corley and Nanogue. Don't want to have a stab at it. Comhaiorle, Nanogue, as in, it's youth council, isn't it?
Yeah, youth council. Yeah.
Nanogue as in N-O fada G. So what is the best way to join up?
So in every county you'll have your own Cordless. So just take Dundalk, you'll have a Cordless somewhere within the county. normally one way to join would be if you go on social media, I'd use Instagram would be probably the best bet, and search up Cordless and Oak. And there's a website as well that you can go on and you can find your local Cordless and just contact the coordinator on it. And that's the best way to join.
It's a bit like first day in secondary school. Go ask someone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think going to your local county council's website, so like the DLR COCO website, is where our Cornelogue has their description. So if you go to your local county council, they should have the Cornelogue linked in there. Or if you go on to, I think the Cornelogue has a website as well. So if you go on there.
Could you? You mentioned Instagram. Are you both on social media with your friends?
Yeah.
Are you on it all the time?
Not for Instagram, no.
Is Instagram your go-to?
No, it'd be Snapchat for me.
It's Snapchat.
Yeah, it'd be Snapchat.
Instagram or WhatsApp or YouTube. Mm. So I don't use social media, so I'm not a big into social media, but I use it for professional.
Does that make you different in school if you're not on it?
It does. Like on the first day of school, I was the weird person as you described, you know. I was the person who'd walk in and say, "Oh, I don't have any social media," and people were looking at me and giving me a death stare. And giving me the death stare and saying, "How could you?" And I was like, "I don't have social media." I was very proud of it. But I think walking in and saying, "I don't have social media," and then seeing everyone having it did put a lot of peer pressure. I tried to avoid it, but I think once I got into Cornelogue, got into all these events, I thought maybe one social media is...
Every now and again, as a professional. There was a thing in the Sunday Times and they did an investigation, or they did an experiment on teenagers without their phones. And they kind of basically found that girls were on social media far more than boys. And that girl, they were kind of saying, if you follow every trend, you get called a basic B. If you don't, you're a weirdo. There's no escape. Your social popularity is totally linked to social media. If you don't post, you get made fun of. If you do lip sync to the wrong song on TikTok, you get made fun of. There's no escape.
Yeah.
I totally agree with...
Keen saying yes.
Yeah, I get that. Like, I get that. Yeah. Even within my own year, I get that.
And that's even with boys?
Yeah, would be as well. So well, sort of, but like, yeah, you will get that kind of you kind of get that division.
You have to be on it, kind of thing.
Yeah, but you can't. Yeah, like yeah, you will be because.
Does it make your day better when you're on social media, when you're browsing it, or you're on your phone a lot?
I mean, it can have its pros and cons. You know, I mean, there's sometimes you go on. I mean, take Instagram for an example, and you can see media, and it'd be like there's a lot of, you can see a lot of good in the world, see a lot of bad in the world, and then you kind of you can see. Influences will be another like kind of aspect as well.
But you're kind of wise to them, aren't you? You know that it's fake. Yeah.
I think you just have to be wise with it and then things go fine. But if you go the wrong road, if you go down the dark road of social media, I think then it becomes a problem because then it starts impacting your own life.
Don't name anybody, but do you know people who are, did you kind of see among your peers, your age group?
I have. I think looking at their experiences, they do get influenced a lot by it. And I think due to the day we are living in, it can become a part of the conversation at school. So if social media is a part of conversation at school, then the intention is that if you don't use social media, you can be a part of the conversation at school.
Yes, so there is.
So there's a link. With the strength of social media, there's become a link between you making friends at school and you having social media. So if you don't have social media, you don't have friends. That kind of thing. So
I mustn't forget in this conversation, because we're just running out of time now, the event that you're having, it's in Dundrum.
Yes.
What are the details as I scramble through pages looking for it here?
So we are having an event day in Dundrum. It's called Bridging the Gap. And it's it's to help students that are transitioning from sixth class into first year. And it's to try and give them tips and tricks on their first year in secondary school and how to, the best ways to settle in.
Yeah. We're also
25th of August.
Yeah.
Beside the Tesco in Dundrum Town Centre. Yeah. Very specific in Dublin. Yeah. And you'll both be there.
Yes, we will be.
Shreya Mishra and Keane Birmingham. Yeah. Thank you both so much. We're going to take one more break before we go. Now, our visiting critic in studio this week is comedian Eric Lawler. Welcome, Eric.
Oliver, thanks for having us.
Not at all. I'm delighted you did this because I didn't know until about a month ago that this was even a thing.
Yeah.
Climbing walls obviously this is getting people out of their comfort zone. So where is your comfort zone?
Where is my comfort zone? My comfort zone is on stage, Oliver, doing stand-up comedy or acting in Fair City or, Electric Picnic this weekend, being a reveller down there.
Shouting your feelings out,
yes,
basically.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And pleading for validation and acceptance from crowds. But awesome walls I went to tackle climbing because it was on everyone's radar because of the Olympics.
Yes, it has been.
Yes.
And this is probably why we were suddenly reminded. People, we've been climbing for years. Awesome Walls is in Dublin somewhere?
It's just off the M50, off the Finglas exit. And it's a brilliant, it's probably the top climbing facility in the country. Yeah. I arrived there for an hour session to be coached by the wonderful Alex, who was you know when you meet somebody who's passionate about their job, and he was telling me everything, and he was giving me the coaching to go up the wall. Awesome. And I said to him, the first thing I said to him was, Awesome Walls, is that a play on Orson Welles? And he just looked at me blankly and went, no. Want all right sound, Jake? Now I think I've given them an idea, you know?
It doesn't sound like it, but...
But we started off with the first climb, Oliver, and he just said, look, climb up whatever way you want, you'll be on a harness, you won't fall, and I'm not great with heights.
And I was about to say, you look fitter than the last time I saw you.
Thanks,
Oliver. Wouldn't say you weren't fit then, but you look like you've done something since.
Yeah, I've been training hard, and the gym is actually near the climbing centre. I train with Philly McMahon.
God, he put you through your paces. Yeah,
so I've been training with him for the last couple of years.
What's the name of his gym again? He's got a kind of a funny
B27.
Name.
B27.
B27, or yeah. Something to do with...
Be yourself, do yourself. I don't know.
7 days a week.
He's told me loads of times.
Very gymmed up name.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're a fit fella. We thought climbing walls might be too comfortable for you.
Yeah.
Because fitness, but apparently
but
not.
But you use different muscles, Oliver. You're not lifting weights, you're not pushing weights, you're not running on a treadmill. Like, on one of the climbs, right, for instance, like, it's a 12-metre wall, and on one of the climbs, I got about 3/4 up, and my foot had a spasm attack. Do you ever get a spasm attack in your foot where cramp comes into your foot?
Usually not on the wall at the time. Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean.
I was on the wall and I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And Alex was like, oh, listen, just if you can't do it anymore, just rest there and take a breather. So I was left kind of hanging in midair.
Really? That's where you rest just up there?
Yeah, just so that the spasm would dissipate from the yeah, and that was another thing as well. When you're coming back down, you have to abseil back down. But you can't. Yeah. You know the way Tom Cruise goes down a big building, he slams into it. I had to walk down it backwards.
Oh, right.
And he slowly lets you down. But yeah, I had to hang around for about 3 minutes until the spasm went from the foot. And once that left me, I was able to get. But you know, there's an enormous sense of achievement when you get to the top. Because you touched the last piece.
12 foot.
And he goes, right, you ready to come down? You're like, yeah. But the sweat, Oliver, right? I went down with my gym gear on. And after the first climb, drenched in sweat. Absolutely drenched in sweat.
And this is a man who goes on stage.
Yeah, this is it. Like, you know what I mean? A man who performs to big crowds and doesn't sweat an inch. But once I got up on that climbing wall, it was out of my comfort zone, as you say. But I did it 3 times. There was another thing as well, Oliver. I don't know if you saw the Olympics. They had the speed climb.
Yeah.
So these lads run up from fly up the wall in 5 seconds.
And they had to do it in the same arena where the breakdancing was going on.
I know, yeah.
Especially when I saw it, I was like, why are they playing such loud music and shouting at the person on the wall? it was behind them.
I was like, that's not worse. Where's my music?
The speed climb, they literally scramble up there.
15 metres, Oliver, right? I can't even run 15 metres in 5 seconds. And these people are climbing 15 seconds. That's wild. I tried that climb and it took me 4 minutes. 4 minutes, and they're doing it in 4 seconds.
That was very good, by the way, for me.
It was all right, yeah, yeah.
So, like, in terms of fitness and how you've been, have you always been into sport and fit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm all through me early years, my youth, I played football, you know. You used to keep yourself. Then I went, discovered women and drink and stopped doing fit things. And it's only later in life I've realised, you know, the importance of physical fitness. And anyone who's thinking about getting fit, join a gym or start climbing. Like, you will use every muscle in your body.
Your kind of fitness thing, how long has that been going?
I'd say I've been doing it, I'd say since the pandemic
ended.
4 years,
yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, piled it on during the pandemic.
Was it very difficult starting it off?
Yeah, that's the worst part. Once you make the first step, that's the hardest part, you know. The great thing about starting off, Oliver, is you're at a fairly heavy weight. And then within a week or two, if you are training hard, it falls off you. So I think in the first 2-3 months, I lost like 12, 13 kilos. And I was like, oh my God, this is great.
In what space of time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How many weeks?
Oh, sorry, in about 3-4 months kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, that would be safe. Well, that'd be safe enough.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I was still eating, you know, and I wasn't. Yeah. And now recently we did a 6-week challenge. So Philly says, right, we want you to train hard, but we also want you to stick to this nutrition plan. And there was about 40 of us in the gym. And I finished second, Oliver. I finished second, just in terms of body shape, body fat loss. And
body shape?
Yeah, body shape.
Who's judging this?
I said, are we bringing a calendar out, Philly? What's the story, you know? Second, and I won a 6-month membership for his recovery studio, which is great. You know, cold water, jacuzzi, sauna.
What kind of prize is that, the cold water?
you won a 6-month membership to the torture chamber. Philly McMahon style prize.
I can imagine the two, yourself and Philly now.
Yeah.
There'll be a lot of manly aggro going on.
Yeah. Lots of testosterone there, Oliver, let me tell you.
Followed by a little cry. And then you scramble up the wall.
Can I have a hug, please?
So someone who has never climbed before, you're harnessed up and it's all safe. So if you go up the wall and you wobble at all, you're probably convinced you're far off the ground.
Even though you're in the harness, Oliver, if you've got a fear of heights, you still have that fear.
Right.
Even if I was to try and jump, you're not going to fall and hit the ground because the guy
has
to. You
start wobbling, don't you, when you're scared?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And look, they're very aware of it as well. Like they say, look, as soon as you feel uncomfortable, let us know and we'll bring you back down. But I was determined. I knew I was coming on your show, Oliver. And I said, I'm doing this for Oliver. I'm doing this for Oliver and the team out there in RTE. And I scaled
doing
up that
it for RTE. Said nobody ever.
Oh, congratulations on the JNLR, by the way.
Oh, right. Wow, whatever that is. That's amazing. Fine. Back to walls. Because we're climbing up the most of the time here anyway. What's the kind of most common mistake people make when they're on the wall? Because I'd imagine it's like you're pulling yourself up.
Yeah.
That would be the hard bit.
So as I said, the first time I was able to grab whatever piece I wanted. Then he tried to make it a little bit more difficult for me the second time. He says, right, Eric, pick a colour. The green, yellow or the red. So then I could only use the yellow or the red or whatever colour he decided. That was more difficult. So you really have to look at the wall and kind of map how you're going to get up. But there were moments, Oliver, when I say I got to about 8 or 9 metres, another 2 or 3 metres to go, and I'd be like stuck trying to look for the next part. And your man Alex would be down below me going, just opposite your right calf, if you just move your legs slightly to the right, you'll see, propel yourself up on that.
Oh, no.
And you still have that fear that you're going to fall.
Yeah.
But because you're on a harness, you're not, and you have to convince yourself you're not going to fall.
You don't fully trust the thing that's there.
You don't. You're relying on Alex.
And must be sore in your feet as well,
yeah.
Is it?
The, yeah, as I said, I got a spasm attack in the foot. But
are like, the special shoes?
No, you see, this is the thing. When you get serious at climbing, you get the special shoes. Oh, I was just in my ordinary trainers, and that's why I didn't break the Olympic record. I think next time I have the climbing shoes on, I'll be in that Olympic team.
Surely you got to do the fun chalk dust thing.
The bouldering, that's called, Oliver, right? That's, yeah. So there's a speed climb, which was very popular. It's over in 5 seconds. But the bouldering is where you really, you're climbing at angles, you're upside down. You have to become literally like a Spider-Man.
So the normal wall, you don't get to use the fun chalk.
No.
Because you'd feel so professional, wouldn't you?
Listen, clouds of. I did that. I went over to the powder thing, wiped the hands, and didn't bother trying the bouldering because I just wanted to have the sensation of rubbing the powder between the hands and looking like an Olympic athlete.
Because the gymnast, I wonder what the effect is of breathing all of that in. Your life.
Well, it's something to do with grip, I think, because the hands are sweaty and, you know, people lifting
weights. I know it's the grip, but they have to, obviously, there's a cloud of dust there. It's chalk, isn't it?
Yeah,
whatever
I hope
it is.
It's chalk.
Well, what do you mean it's chalk, okay, to breathe in? Somebody tell us, if Simone Biles is listening, 5-1-5-1, how are your lungs? So you absolutely loved it.
I loved it.
So when you said you use different group of muscles, when you figured it out, what muscles are you, where does it come from?
I think mostly you're using your back muscles and also, like, your fingers. Like, you really need strong fingers.
That'd be the worst, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because now you can get a good grip on the things, but, like, you're pulling your whole body weight up and you're using your foot as leverage as well. So your toes and your fingers, you're like, oh, I need to start training my toes and fingers a bit more. If you want to become a serious climber, there's tiny bits of your body that have never been
How do you gym work out your fingers?
I don't know. Can you get tiny dumbbells or something like that? I don't know. Just heavy rings on your fingers or something.
Piano?
Piano. Yeah, exactly.
You can come in having learned piano to the same guy that you crack the Orson Welles joke.
Yes.
I've been doing Chopin's. So that's how you blank again.
Just get up the wall.
Yeah, yeah. Come here, you as well as comedy, you're now a League of Ireland commentator.
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
Allegedly.
I am. As anyone that knows me knows, I'm a big Bowes fan, you know, and Bowes has a voluntary ethos, so it's a people's club, whatever. But we also, there's a thing called LOI TV, and people subscribe to it and watch League of Ireland matches. So it's the home club that provides the commentators. Now, Bowes do have an array of commentators, professional broadcasters, really good people like Stephen Doyle and all that. And,
exactly, yeah.
And sometimes people aren't available and they go, Eric, would you fancy a go at this? And I'm like, wow.
You say words out loud, Eric.
Yes, words out loud into a microphone, commentating on football, which I adore, about my favourite club in the world. But the first time I did it, Oliver, we were playing Drogheda a few weeks ago. And I thought, you know, professional setup, go into the gantry, the teams would be there in front of me. No, no such thing. So I knew all the Bowes players, but I didn't know the Drogheda players. I knew some of them. So I was like, and there's the number 7 off Drogheda, and he's got the pass into the ginger lad, and the ginger lad has it now.
I prepare commentary like that sometimes.
But this is it, Oliver. I'm getting a lot of texts going, do you know what? I really enjoyed your commentary because it's completely irreverent and off the beaten track, like, you know.
And because you're a Bowes fan, then how can you commentate on your own teams?
Yeah.
Because I'd imagine when you're in the stands, you're unbroadcastable.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's, you know, it's watershed stuff. but commentating, because you're such a fan, you have to, I suppose, try and be a little bit unbiased. But I can't stop that. I can't. So but we commentated last week, Bowes were 2-0 up against Waterford at half-time. Flying in great form, and then within 30 seconds of the second half, Waterford had pulled a goal back, and you can hear in the commentary my voice sinking. I think when Waterford got the third goal to go 3-2 up, I wanted to swear. I was like, and I had to stop myself, and I had to go, there's a goal for Waterford. You know what I mean? Just like, I was so angry, and my co-commentator is a Bowes fan as well, and the two of us were like this, oh my god. So that's a goal for Waterford. Well done,
1,000 calories.
And I did. There was one or two comments from Waterford fans going, I was delighted because that commentator was so biased.
Obviously, not understanding. There's something about League of Ireland fans, and particularly Bowes, I think.
Yeah.
It's that I almost fear talking to them, like a Gael Gore who's really excellent Irish. I don't want to speak Irish to them because they'll go, he doesn't know his Tishel Ginnijack. Like, I better not say anything about anything here because, you know, we're supposed to know everything.
Yeah.
Suppose now are not going so well.
No, we're struggling. Let's be honest, Oliver. Yeah. We're struggling. And Pats and Rovers doing great in Europe. We're delighted. No, we're not. struggling big time at the moment. But, you know, Bowes fans, they have this motto, born to moan. All right. But I'm one of the I'm the glass half full kind of guy, and I think with Alan Reynolds, the manager, he's got off to a very bad start. But I have faith in him, and I think I think we will get it right. I don't think we'll be relegated.
You have faith with them until you come up with a good chant that says otherwise. So it's the relegation zone is the bottom two, I presume. It's like
yeah. So the bottom team gets relegated, and the second bottom team goes into a playoff with the runners up in the first division or something like that.
Because we had Arthur Matthews here a few weeks ago. He's a Drogheda fan.
Who's that?
Arthur Matthews.
Oh yeah, yeah.
See, they're rock bottom.
Yeah, they're at the bottom. No, Dundalk are at the bottom. Oh, Drogheda are just above them, and Bowes are looking over the shoulder at the two County Louth rivals, going, lads, this is getting serious.
Should be
a few weeks ago, we were going, we might get Europe, and now we're going, geez, we might get Kerry next season. You know.
You don't. When was the last time Bowes were down?
They were never relegated.
Yeah, never.
Never.
So this is really,
hope
really,
I'm not
bad.
It, Oliver,
this is really,
yeah,
bad season.
Yeah,
but there's a few months left to go.
Yeah, there's about 11 or 12 games left. You know, plenty of time. But we've got a lot of hard matches.
We're playing Shells next.
Shells twice we have in the next couple of weeks, and then we've got Rovers and Derry as well. So it's, you know, it's really up in
the hoops. See, I know things now. Is it okay? Is my League of Ireland t-shirt going to jog up to scratch? Electric Picnic, you are going to Electric Picnic?
I am, Oliver, can't wait.
As a spectator, I presume, as well as performer?
Yes, I'm going down in the morning. I'm doing my podcast there tomorrow night, 20 to 7 in the Mindfield. You must be joking. Myself and Will Ah-Wai.
That's the name of it. Yeah. It did sound that you were just casually going.
I know, anytime I say I've got a podcast, people go, you must be joking. I say, that's it, exactly, yeah. So it's me and Will Ah-Wai, and it's been going great for us, Oliver. We kicked it off in March and it's flying, and we get all sorts of guests in. Sometimes we just fly solo and shoot the breeze ourselves. But we've got our guest, this is our first ever live show, and we've got Maisie Adam, who's a brilliant UK comedian.
Yeah.
She's coming on the podcast.
Really good.
And she's headlined the Comedy Tent as well. And I'm doing the Comedy Tent then on Sunday at 2:15.
Oh, is there a name on the Comedy Tent?
Is there a name?
It's just a Comedy
just
Tent.
Just a Comedy Tent.
Oh, is it? Yeah. You'd think I'd come up with something there, would you? Yeah. Willa White, love Willa White as well.
Do you love
former Chinese takeaways.
Oh, yes.
Is he from the same part of the world as you?
He is, Ballymun, yeah.
Oh, he's Ballymun as well, brilliant. And Jane Gowan, who we were mentioning earlier on, has done this article on people too old for nightclubs. I presume she'd say you should be nowhere near the EP.
I was listening to that, Oliver, and I was bristling with rage in the waiting area, going, I cannot believe.
More calories lost.
Yeah. How I'm in shape. I'm just apparently angry. I have a six pack. It's just, yeah, and I heard that. I'm like, I'm going down to Electric Picnic. My son has gone down there. He's 21. He's gone down with all his mates, and he's going to be raving with his da in the woods.
Does he know there. That?
He does. And he's embraced it. And all his mates think I'm a star.
Are you sure? He's getting his lift down. He's going, right, good luck, Dad.
Yeah, in fairness, he's going, listen, Dad, I'm just here for the plus one. Good luck. I'll see you on Monday.
He's one of the twins.
Yeah, Adam is the. But Adam and Alex, like, they don't even look like brothers or behave like brothers. Never mind twins. Completely different interests.
Oh, great.
But I was only saying to one of your researchers there, Oliver, like, the one thing that I think would unite both of them in a common thing is the climbing. I think both of them would be amazing. I think they'd both love the climbing. Alex is a footballer. He's very fit. Adam. He's fit, but he doesn't really do much. He doesn't do any sports. But I remember as a kid when he was younger, he'd go to these play centres and he was like Spider-Man climbing up the walls.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure, the kids love it.
Yeah, so when I told him, he said, yeah, I'll be all over that.
Are they going to do it? Are you going to
go up to Austin Walls again, the three
so
of us?
So you love this so much, you're going back?
100%, Oliver, yeah.
And bringing the boys?
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, how much is a session or whatever you call it?
Do you know what? Because I got it for free, Oliver, I didn't even ask. But I'm sure they have a website.
We will find out because we have good people. We need to say what it is. Anything else?
Well, do you know what, Oliver? I came on mainly to promote me solo stand-up show.
Hang on, that's not how it usually works. Go on, which is in the Laughter Lounge, is it?
No, it's not in the Laughter Lounge, Oliver. It's in the Liberty Hall Theatre.
Sorry. The podcast is brought to you.
Yes.
No, sorry, the Electric Picnic is brought to you. But I really should read these things before.
The podcast is with the Laughter Lounge and Joe.
Very good, yes, that's good. So you're a standalone show.
Yes.
Which is?
Is Lawler by Nature. See what I did there, Oliver?
Lawler by Nature.
So it's usually me just laughing, that the audience just staring at me. So it's the biggest solo show I've ever done. It's 400 seats, September 19th, and I'd love to sell it out. There's a few tickets
September
left,
19th,
good few tickets left.
And it's in?
In the Liberty Hall Theatre.
In Liberty Hall, oh, that's a lovely theatre, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, I've done Panto there before.
Have you?
Yeah.
I can't see the stage really working for Panto. It's like a proper, like...
It's like a circular kind of thing?
Yeah, I suppose it's just a lovely, really nice theatre. I've only been there once or twice there recently. And I don't think people actually often know from outside of Dublin that there's a theatre Theatre Liberty.
I know. It's a union building. Like, you
it
know.
Is, yeah.
So if there's any...
You said that in a way we're going, yeah, I'm into this. as a comedian.
Left
works.
Wing. Yeah.
Self-employed capitalism.
I'd be saying to the people, don't use the toilets here if you're a Republican because they're the Union Jacks. Here you go. Here's a joke there, your honour.
That's the type of thing. Lawler, my name.
It'd be a lot better than that, Oliver, let me tell you.
The Gen Z Diary, we should send them as a visiting critic to Eric Oliver's gig, September 19th. I think it would shock anyone, some 50. Eric, thanks so much. There you go. Campbell's Political Soup, Heroes, Teenagers and Wall-Banging Comics. Sure, where else would you get it? It is the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, you can pop us an email anytime at all. Oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you all. Farewell, Slán. Thanks.